युक्तकर्मफलं त्यक्त्वा शान्तिम् आप्नोति नैष्ठिकीम्। अयुक्तकामकारेण फले शक्तो निबध्यते। The steadily devoted soul attains unadulterated peace because he offers the result of all activities to me, whereas a person who is not in union with the divine, who is greedy for the fruits of his labor, becomes entangled. Purport by his divine grace, Srila Abhaya Charanaravinda Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The difference between a person in Krishna consciousness and a person in bodily consciousness is that the former is attached to Krishna, whereas the latter is attached to the results of his activities. The person who is attached to Krishna works for him only is certainly a liberated person, and he has no anxiety over the result of his work. In the Bhagavatam, the cause of anxiety over the result of an activity is explained as being one's functioning in the conception of duality. That is, without knowledge of the absolute truth, Krishna. Krishna is the supreme absolute truth, the personality of Godhead. In Krishna consciousness, there is no duality. All that exists is a product of Krishna's energy, and Krishna is all good. Therefore, activities in Krishna consciousness are in the absolute plane. They are transcendental and have no material effect. One is therefore filled with peace in Krishna consciousness. But one who is entangled in profit calculation for sense gratification cannot have that peace. This is the secret of Krishna consciousness. Realization that there is no existence besides Krishna is the platform of peace and fearlessness. Translation: this steadily devoted soul attains unadulterated peace because he offers the results of all activities to me, whereas a person who is not in union with the divine, who is greedy for the results of his labor, becomes entangled. It is my very great happiness to be with all of you this evening at this very auspicious and holy abode of Mr. Mafatlal, wherein there have been hundreds of such satsang programs for the illumination of the consciousness of so many sincere souls over the years. Illumination comes through knowledge and realization. Knowledge gives us the information of how to live and why we should live according to the principles of truth. To discriminate between truth and illusion is the beginning of knowledge. Truth, according to the Gita, is to understand who we really are, what is our relationship with our source or God, what is our relationship with this material nature, why we are suffering and enjoying, and what is ultimately the goal of life. Essentially, each and every one of us is a living person who wants pleasure, who cannot tolerate the existence of frustration and pain. That person is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. That person is part of the Supreme Truth, or God. That person is eternally the servant of the Absolute Truth. And the nature of that service is to bring about the awakening of love and ecstasy within our own being. Service to God brings about eternal ecstatic love. In the pure state of consciousness, service to illusion brings about entanglement. The soul is real, and the body that we're living in is real. What is the illusion? When the soul thinks, I am the body, that is illusion. The soul is in the body. The soul is not the body. The soul has a purpose to serve through the body. The purpose of the soul is not to satisfy the body. Rather, the purpose of the body is to satisfy the needs of the soul. And this essential mix-up is the cause of all the wars, the frustrations, the miseries within the entire creation. This slight mix-up. Truth is that the soul is within the body, and the body is meant to serve the purposes of the soul. Illusion is that the soul is meant to satisfy the purpose of this body by acting in so many ways for sense enjoyment. So when this misconception is simply reversed, then we're on the path of perfection. And that is what Bhagavad Gita is explaining. We find Bhagavad Gita is being spoken on a battlefield. There are two sides. There are the Kurus and the Pandavas. This is a historical incident. But it also is orchestrated in such a way to teach a very good lesson to humanity. The Pandavas were devotees of the Lord who wanted to perform their prescribed duties for the satisfaction of God, in a sense of detachment and service. The Kurus represented a body of people who wanted to exploit the resources of nature according to the maximum possible capacity for their own greed to be fulfilled. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, greed could never be fulfilled. Lust could never be fulfilled. Why? Because it's not simply the senses that are greedy. It's the soul. The soul is eternal. The soul is longing for unlimited pleasure, unlimited love, eternal satisfaction, because that is its nature. And that's what it finds in its relationship with Krishna, or God. And it will never be content until it finds that eternal, unlimited beauty of Krishna. It is that soul that has that need that is trying to enjoy through this temporary, very, very limited, fragile tabernacle called a human body. And through this body, trying to enjoy various temporary objects within this world. But can any of these objects, could the body itself possibly satiate the needs of the immortal soul looking for the oceanic bliss of Krishna? Never. Therefore, however much you accumulate, however much satisfaction, it's never enough. If you're starving in a desert and someone puts one tiny drop of water upon the surface of your tongue, it gives you a moment's blissful relief. But the next moment, it evaporates. And you're even more thirsty than you were if that drop didn't touch you. Because a little is worse than nothing. Because it just agitates you. You just get a little taste of pleasure and you think, I have to have more. According to the Holy Scriptures, this is what the pleasures of material life are compared to. It's like a desert. And whatever gratification we may get, it's like a drop of water in the desert. Yes, it gives you some pleasure. But that pleasure only further agitates and aggravates your condition of starvation for real pleasure. So greed is insatiable. It's not, if you go to the pages of the business magazines, that you find that the multimillionaires or the multibillionaires are satisfied with what they have. They have to have more. Why? People think that sex life is pleasurable. Are the prostitutes who are having sex life 10, 15 times a day, are they satisfied? People think that it's pleasurable to take a drink of alcohol. Have you ever found someone who's satisfied drinking a little alcohol? The more you drink, the more you become addicted to it, the more you need it. The more you have to have it, the more you cannot live without it. This is material enjoyment in its very grosser aspects. So any acquirement, any gratification of the mind and senses is insatiable. Because it's the soul that's looking for Krishna, that's trying to get Krishna through these. Not possible. So Bhagavad Gita is explaining what is real intelligence. Real intelligence is restraining one's endeavors for the false hopes of happiness through material enjoyment, and refocusing our consciousness toward looking for that satisfaction in Krishna. How? Spirituality is dynamic. It is practical. It is not that everyone can just sit in the Padmasan with back erect, neck straight, focusing on the internal existence of Brahman within one's heart. What to speak of even Krishna within the heart. This is not what Gita teaches. Gita teaches we have to channel our energy through our very occupational propensities by offering it as a service to the Supreme Personality of God. And this everyone and anyone can do. The only qualification is some sincerity of the heart and proper guidance and association. Anyone who says they can't, for a sadhu, they translate the word can't into real language, which means won't. That's all. Our Guru Maharaj, he remembered, he was reading a newspaper and he saw a little caption where there was a wife and a husband, and the wife was telling the husband, chant, chant, chant. And the husband said, can't, can't, can't. Nobody actually can't. It's just a matter of, you won't. Why? Krishna explains in Gita. Yat karoshi rasnashi yajtu hoshita dasyat. Yat tapasyasi kontiya tat kurushma dharma. Whatever you're able to do, do it for me. With the right purpose, do the right things. Whether you are a warrior like Arjuna, or whether you are a businessman, a an engineer, a doctor, a lawyer, a student, a housewife, whatever one may be, an accountant. If one just does his work for Krishna, in a consciousness of serving Krishna, that very work connects one to the divine. And through that connection, we gradually become purified and taste the sweetness of the nectar of the very nature of the soul's relation with God. This world is full of problems. There is no solution to the problems of the world. I'm sorry to say it. Philanthropists, politicians, they may be talking about so many promises for solutions, but there's no solution. The only solution is to get out of the consciousness of this world. This world is a muddy pond. You'll get muddy and you'll suffer as long as you're in this pond. But if you're like a lotus, you can be in the pond, but not of the pond. So spiritual life is to make our consciousness like that lotus, where it's simply above the temporary dualities that are constantly creating so much conflict within this world of dualities. Can you make the ocean dry? It's easier to make the entire ocean dry than to make this world a place without problems. If you look at history, history is just the documentation of the problems that men, societies, races, religions, and nations face generation after generation after generation. And most of those problems are usually massive conflicts of wars and strife. Is that not how history is documented? Why? Because that's the reality of this world. Here in India, modern history, there was the Mughal Empire, there was the British Empire, and after that, how many difficult situations? World history. Just within the time that we remember, World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, Pakistan-Indian War, wars in Iran and Iraq, wars in Israel, wars every day breaking out in Africa. 20 million people massacred, innocent civilians in Russia, and no one in the world knew a thing about it. 11 million people killed by the Nazi Empire, and practically no one knew anything about it. And these things are going on, and they've always gone on. This is the world we live in. There's nuclear bombs. You know, there's one pointed right in this direction, obviously. And it's not the most sane, level-headed, self-controlled, saintly people that are in charge of whether you push the button or not. This is the world we live in. As they say in the West, it's a dog-eat-dog world. Even within our families, it's becoming more and more like that. So if we actually want to create peace in the world, we have to first create peace in ourselves. And then, according to our capacity, we can give other people the opportunity to feel peace within themselves. And the more people that have peace within themselves, the more of a peaceful arrangement there'll be in the world. However, the nature of this world is not everyone will accept such a virtuous life. So it will always be a pond of muddled, muddy water. Why? Because the same tendencies that are within all of us to to the degree they're uncontrolled, people become demoniac. Unfulfilled lust, unfulfilled greed, unfulfilled anger, unfulfilled pride, unfulfilled envy and illusion. We all have these things in our hearts. And to the degree we're able to control them, we're saintly. And to the degree we're not able to control them, we're very, very great menaces to society and ourselves. So in today's institutions of education, there's very little talk about controlling these propensities within us. We learn a lot about trying to be controllers of material nature according to our particular field of activity. But how to control our own inner nature? That is the secret to success of life. That is what Sri Bhagavad Gita is explaining. How to control our own inner nature and direct it toward the divine union of Krishna through service. That same energy that is seeking so much fulfillment and enjoyment in so many avenues of life, if it is just redirected in a spirit of humility and service toward God, it will open the treasure chest of truth and fulfillment. In this particular verse we're reading today, Krishna is speaking of unadulterated peace to one who offers the results of his activities to me. Whereas a person who is not in union with the divine, who is greedy for the fruits of his labor, becomes entangled. The Varnashram system, which is created by Krishna, teaches each and every person, according to their propensities, their inner nature, how to live in a fulfilling, dynamic, and productive way within this world. The greatest illusion that foolish people conceive is that people who are actually religious, they are not productive within society. Perhaps we have all heard this claim that if you really want to be productive, efficient, and successful in your particular field of occupation, then religion is a distraction. And therefore, even so-called religious people, they put their religion in a particular bracket within their lifestyle that's kept somewhere along the side. And they take it off whenever they're in a pious mood to feel some sense of superstitious security for the afterlife. Or perhaps by some religious function and belief, it will give us possible good luck in our material endeavors in this life. But Bhagavad Gita is speaking of the deepest, most profound science of the spiritual aspect of existence and how it is the origin and the orchestrating power between everything within creation. Real religion, real spirituality, is to understand how to harmonize the power of the soul, the unlimited power of the soul, the power of love, compassion, and peace, with our activities in this practical life. That is spirituality. So in whatever particular occupation we may have, we perform it to its highest efficient potential because it is an expression of our love for God. There is no greater power than love. And there is no higher love than the love of the soul for God. When that energy is released from within our heart, and it is directed as an expression through our work, what is the capacity of our work? What is the attention in which we work? A mother does not get paid for taking care of a baby child. She's not making 20 rupees an hour for taking care of her child. And if the child wakes her up at night, she doesn't get 30 rupees overtime after 9 o'clock. She's working selflessly, around the clock. And if she's a good mother, she'll put her complete concentration and attention on making that child as happy as she possibly can. She'll be 24 hours a day acutely attentive to protect her child from danger, to give her child the best possible nourishment, and to create an environment by which it could be happy. Is that not a mother? Can you pay a person to put her heart and soul into being so efficient as that? No doubt, there are neglectful mothers, but we're talking about a mother who has some love. That mother, if she loves her child, if there's 150 other children in the room, when her child cries, she'll know exactly who it is. For us men, they all sound the same. They look the same, they sound the same. But a mother, she knows. Because her mind is that intensely immersed in her service. Why? Because there's love. Love is the greatest power. Arjuna was the greatest warrior on earth because he was fighting as an expression of pure love for God. Similarly, whatever we do, the ultimate potential is achieved when it is done in a mood of service. But that service, we have to simultaneously attached and detached. How is it possible to be simultaneously attached and detached while performing an activity? To one who is in divine consciousness, they are attached to what they're doing only for the satisfaction of who they're doing it for. But they're not attached to the results of what they do. It's ultimately in God's hands whether we are success or failure. On the material stratum of existence. But if we perform our work with a sincere, earnest effort to please the Lord, to offer the fruits of our actions to the Lord, spiritually, that is our success. If a businessman in Krishna consciousness goes to an adventure and knows that I'm going to offer the fruits of my action for the noble service of the Lord, therefore I'm going to work harder than anyone else. whether he success or fails, he's blissful because he knows that I have done it for the right cause. And it's all in Krishna's hands what the result will be. If a student studies very hard because they want to get a degree in some sort of education to use in God's service, and they earnestly and honestly try their best in the spirit of devotion, whether they pass or fail makes really very little difference. What makes the difference is that they have pleased the Lord. That is detachment. Attachment to the object of our service, which is Krishna. But detachment from the exploitation of the results of our service by our own ego. When we have that simultaneous attachment and detachment, then we can be happy under any situation in life, like a lotus flower. It's unaffected by the condition of the pond of water beneath it. The impersonalist philosophers, they try to purely cultivate the sense of detachment. That they really just don't care about anything of this world. We'll just throw it all away. It's all illusion. It's all Maya. That may free us from many complications, but there's no bliss in detachment. Bliss comes where there is love, and that love comes from attachment to the object of our love. So what is real detachment? Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita. It means to not be concerned so much for the dualities that are constantly trying to tear our consciousness away from our real purpose of life. We are detached from sense enjoyment and exploitation, and we are attached to the service of the Lord. That is the formula that is meant to bring us to the highest perfection of life. That is bhakti. To clean the consciousness is the means by which we can have direct experience and realization of how to work in this world in divine consciousness, rather than in polluted, exploitative consciousness. That is why we have come tonight. By hearing the truth, as it is spoken in Bhagavad Gita, it cleans our consciousness. It gives us direction. It gives us conviction. It gives us determination to do what's right and to resist what's wrong. When we chant the names of the Lord, which is the Yuga Dharma, it awakens our spiritual propensities. It gives us the strength, the spiritual power to resist our animalistic, materialistic propensities. The difference between an animal and a human is not the difference between someone who wears hair all over his body and a person who wears a three-piece suit and a necktie and a diamond ring and drives in a Mercedes-Benz. That's not the difference between animal and human. Because most people in their silken suits, neckties, and jewelries, they're more animalistic than the animals in the jungles by the quality of their consciousness. They're greedy, They're envious. They're always searching for different ways to satisfy their senses through eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Human life is those who detach themselves from these animalistic propensities and live according to the sacred principle of service. The chanting of God's holy names, the association of God's devotees, is the simple and necessary means by which we uncover these divine propensities that are within us. And simultaneously, we want to express them according to our realizations through whatever we do in this world. We have people today, Radha Pati Prabhu, Krishna Nam Prabhu, Krishna Chandra Prabhu, Radha Krishna Prabhu. Some of them are very active people within society. But their consciousness is completely different. Whatever they're doing it in a spirit of service to God, service to humanity, in a spirit of compassion. They're not really concerned with what they get out of it. Therefore, they're on the path of real peace. So yes, what is bhakti? What is real spirituality? Is the most practical, realistical, logical way of living within this world. Absolutely contrary to the illusory hypothesis that religion is the opiate of the masses. That spiritualism makes one unproductive within society. I was once giving a lecture in a college that was training people to be accountants. One student after the lecture, who was in a very aggressive, I think he was more aggressive to show off his prowess in debate than he was to actually search for the truth. But he was very aggressive. He spoke with such fervor, like a politician campaigning. He said, "Everything you're saying is useless." This is just after I gave a lecture. He said, "Everything you're saying is absolutely useless as impractical." I said, "Thank you very much. Can you explain why?" He said, "Yes. What if everyone in the world became a sadhu like you? Who would grow the food? Who would transport the food? Who would protect the people? What would happen to society? Everything would be ruined. Therefore, your religion is useless." Hare Krishna. So I had to respond by saying something. I asked him, "What would happen in the world if everyone was an accountant like you? Who would grow the food? Who would transport the food? If everyone was an accountant, there would be nobody to account for. The entire world would be unemployed." "We need you as an accountant. We need sadhus too. We need businessmen. We need farmers. We need artists. We need architects. We need laborers. We need teachers. All of these occupations are required. And when everyone works in harmony with their own inner nature in the service of God, to glorify God, then there's peace. Then there's fulfillment. Then there's realization. So you be an accountant, but do it for Krishna. And you'll not only make a little money in this world, which will be taken away at death or before, but you will earn the the innermost treasure of eternal wealth, the wealth of your own soul, the bliss of your soul. Share that wealth. When you begin to taste the wealth of the treasure of your soul, then you become very charitable. There's no end, no limit to how much you can give. And every act that you do is an expression of giving that charity, of God's love, God's mercy, God's compassion to the world. If everyone had that mood, this would be Vaikuntha. Thank you very much. Is there any questions? If anyone has any questions, we can try to answer. Yes. What is important is your purpose. Your purpose in life. What do you work for? Probably money. Is that safe to say? Yes? If they stop paying, will you still do that work? Be honest. So you work for money. Everyone works for money, basically. So the question is, what are you going to do with your money? You have a house. So you invest some of that money in your house. So what is your house's purpose? If your house is just a residence for eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and doing your own thing whenever you so want, to sit and watch television and eat and drink whatever you want, then your house is just a place of material illusion. And that means all the money that you're making to invest in that house is simply for the purpose of material illusion. Therefore, the more money you make, the more you facilitate karma that will eventually cause you great, great misery. Yes? So better you don't make anything, and you have less facility to engage in sinful activities or wasteful activities. Now, what if your home is a temple of God, where you have the deities of the Lord? All the food you buy is offered to the Lord as bhoga, and then offered to your family as prasadam, where your family is trained to and inspired to put Krishna in the center. You have a car. You use it for devotional activities. So if Krishna is in the center of your life and you're living by spiritual principles, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, no meat eating, if we're getting our pleasure from hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord and serving the Lord, then our money is actually used in God's service. That means your work is connected to the divine. It's not so much what you're doing, but what you're doing it for, and who you're doing it for. Does that answer your question? So this spiritual guidance is very, very important. How to spiritualize our life. This home, to invite general people, to invite sadhus, to use our home as a charitable place to enlighten others, to give prasad to others, that means your home is a temple of the Lord being utilized for wonderful service to the Lord. That means the money that's being used for the home is used in God's service. And that means the act of your work, which is to make that money, is also God's service. Arjuna was a warrior. That was his work. But he was doing it for Krishna. Therefore, it was bhakti. As he was shooting arrows into human bodies, that was pure bhakti. Because it was done not only in the spirit of devotion, but actually according to the was pure bhakti. Because it was done not only in the spirit of devotion, but actually according to the will of God. So knowledge has to be there. Through the scriptures, through the sadhus, through the gurus, we have to learn what does God want and how to live in harmony with his desire. And when we do, everything in our life becomes sacred. When our family is centered around Krishna, our family becomes sacred. Our home becomes an ashram. You have heard grihastha ashram. When a householder, wife, husband, children, mother, father, when they're God-centered, when they're living under the instructions and inspiration of God-conscious people, then their home becomes an ashram, becomes a holy place. Any other question? Yes.
My job is to collect duties and taxes for the government. During my course of duties, sometimes people are indirectly harassed, or some innocent people also are affected. Did I have incursion? Or I have dismissed Krishna.
Say again.
Dina incursion.
What do you do?
By indirectly. When I indirectly people are harassed by my activities.
What activity?
Collects taxes for the government.
Collects taxes.
Taxes for the government.
You're very popular occupation.
It is said that devotees are to be very sober. But if I show the soberness there, then probably I may not be able to do my duties for the government properly. What should I do?
What should you do? You should understand that we all owe many taxes to God. He is supplying the sun, the rain, the earth. But no one thinks in terms of paying anything back to God. So you should be aware of that, first of all. Second of all, you should be as honest and as pious as you possibly can under your particular situation. And with the, obviously, you're getting paid. With the money that you make from it, which you do as honestly and as piously as possible, then you use that money in a God-centered lifestyle. Chant the holy names of the Lord sincerely. Live according to the four principles: no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, no meeting. Associate with devotees. Give in charity a part of your money for the purpose of enlightening people's hearts and souls. Give in charity to your own family in such a way that you make your house a ashram dedicated to the service of God. In other words, after you're finished with that tax-paying office, live the rest of your life in a very, very devotional way and use the money that you receive to create a very devotional environment in your life and share it with others. And Krishna is in your heart. If he sees you're using the fruits of your labor in a very, very proper way, and you're trying to perform your work as honestly and as fairly as possible, then you'll go back to Godhead. But in your profession, you need to chant very attentively. Does that answer your question? It's not an impediment. If you're taking all kinds of bribes and everything else, then there will be sinful reaction. But if you're just doing your duty according to how you have to do it, and you're trying to be as fair, as honest, as humanly possible under these difficult circumstances, and you live by these principles that I have explained, then you are sadhu. Does that give some hope? Thank you.
How can we follow these principles as a sportsman, you know? Because basically as a sportsman you're playing for fame and glory and money. So, I mean, it's contrary to the principles that you suggested. So how is it possible to, you know, combine the two?
Sportsman, what kind of sport?
Cricket.
Pretty well. So you are famous cricket man?
I'm not famous.
But you'd like to be. There you go. Everything is possible. There was once a very famous musician. Why do people become musicians? This is rock and roll. You know what is rock and roll? If you know cricket, you also know rock and roll. Not a very religious activity. So this man happened to be in a rock and roll band that was the most famous in the entire planet Earth. You heard of them. Most famous on Earth. To this day, even though they're long gone. So this person became Krishna conscious. He was the lead guitar player. And he actually wanted to give it up. But Srila Prabhupada explained to him that you became like you are because you were very attached to making money and getting fame. And now you have all these things. Use it for Krishna. Write and sing songs about Krishna. Live an exemplary life that people will want to follow you and become Krishna conscious. Use it as a service to God and service to others, whatever benefits you have achieved. And live a very pure and pious life in your own private and public style. And you will do great service. This person did. He wrote and sang a song that was number one song in practically all of America. They still play it on the radios today, 25 years later. And a very major portion of the song, he's just chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. From that song, millions of people started chanting Hare Krishna. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people joined Hare Krishna temples all over the world because they heard that song and wanted to, and then they wanted to read the books about it, and then by reading the books they were convinced they became devotees. Srila Prabhupada was very grateful. In introduction to one book he was thanking him as calling him a gentleman. So you could use fame. When you have fame, you have influence over other people's lives. If If you have influence over people's lives and you're living a very spiritually oriented life, you're free from vices, you're regularly chanting the holy names, and you tell people, I'm trying to win only so that I can have more influence to help you to understand that you should chant Hare Krishna. And you should live a pious and godly life so that you can be happy. I'm doing this for you, not for me. And the money I make, I'll use it in the service of the Lord. And the fame that I acquire, I'll use it in the service of the Lord. So you can do it. You can also become a brahmachari, but you can do this too. Yes.
You said in your lecture that the spiritual knowledge is blissful. Do you think this knowledge should be a part of curriculum in all the schools and colleges all over the world? Because it can probably end all the war all over the world and create the friendship and happiness.
Of course. I think it should. Definitely. Rajabhijya Rajaguyam. Krishna says this knowledge is the king of education, the most confidential knowledge. And because it gives direct perception of the self through realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting and joyfully performed. And this Srila Prabhupada was very much concerned. He approached many of the top leaders of India, up to the prime ministers, and appeal to them, please, let the true teachings of Gita be mandatory to be taught in schools. And it doesn't even have to be done in a sectarian way. It can be done in a way that people of all different religions can get immense benefit without even converting. Because the teachings of Gita are universal. But in the world today, there's the two extremes. There's fundamentalism and there's secularism. Srila Prabhupada explained, real secularism should be that everyone should follow the true teachings of their own religion without intruding our own religion on someone else's. But everyone should follow the path and the laws of God. And the paths and the laws of God should be presented in a universal and scientific method. Without that, our schools are training people to be technically powerful, but the inner content of their consciousness is deprived. So what will be the gain of the world? We see the gain of the world. Air pollution, earth pollution, water pollution, massive buildups of militaries and massive buildups of arsenals and bombs, so much crime, so much mafia, so much communalism, alcoholism, drugism, prostitution, and basic frustration. The American Health Journal. Without doubt, the most dangerous, miserable, killing disease of the 21st century will not be AIDS, will not be hepatitis C, will not be cancer, will not be heart disease, will not be diabetes. It will be mental illness. Because as society is advancing materially, it's deteriorating it's deteriorating within people's minds, within people's hearts. The values of life, the content of righteousness is deteriorating day by day. Although we're finding so many new discoveries for new weapons, for new electrical appliances, for your new computer hardware and software, for faster cars and better jet airplanes. But is there any less misery? Is there any deeper fulfillment in life through all these devices? So yes, we're teaching people how to be technically very powerful, but their inner conscience is deprived. And when your inner spirituality is deprived, then you're more subjected to the influence of greed and anger and envy and lust and all of these other things. And what happens when all these material powers are in the hands of people who are servants of the basest, lowest propensities? What happens is you have the world we know today. In America, America is leading the world in material prosperity. But let's look at the prosperity. Do I have time to give a little my own experience? I grew up in the 1950s and 60s. In the 1950s, we didn't have push-button phones. We had to dial the phones. We had to go... That's the only kind of phones there was. But now in the 90s, you just go... In the 50s, if you wanted to make a call, you had to go to this phone booth and you had to go... You had to put coins again and again. Keep putting coins, and more coins. Otherwise, you're cut off and you're dialing. Sometimes cut off. This is America. Now everyone has their cellular phones. There's anywhere they are. They just go, just one. You don't even have to, they have phones now. You don't even have to push a button. You just say, my home. And it goes, my office. You don't even have to pick it up. You're driving in your car now, and you just say to some mysterious existence in your car, you say, IBM headquarters, and all of a sudden, and then they say, IBM headquarters, can I help you? And then you just talk. Well, there's not even a home. So the dials of the 50s is way, way beyond. And as far as television, when I was a little boy, the televisions of America in Chicago, there were four stations. And every time you wanted to turn the station, you had to get up from your bed, walk over to the television, and crank it. You had to go... Now, in Chicago, there's 120 stations. And you just lay in your bed and just push a button and it goes... It's advancement of civilization. In those days, the airplanes... Did you ever fly airplanes in the 50s? The airplanes, you get on, and the first thing that they tell you is there's a bag that you vomit in right in front of your seats. And that was the part of the airplane that everyone was most eager to understand where exactly it was. It was like, it took hours and hours to get anywhere. Now they don't even put vomit bags in airplanes anymore. And there's these big, they're like cities practically. Advancement of civilization. In the 50s, there were no computers. There were some computers, but one computer, it would take the size of this room. Now that same computer's purpose, and 100 times more, you can just carry around and it's this big. It just goes... Advancement of civilization. So these are a few things. What to speak of every aspect of life. So people consider that was people of the 90s in America, when they think of how they lived in the 50s, it was like primitive and barbaric by material calculations. However, I was just looking at an evaluation of what the problems were in the schools in the 1950s in America, and what the problems in the schools are in the 1990s of America. The biggest problems that the teachers were complaining about was talking during class. Putting chewing gum and sticking it to the bottom of the desks. Pushing each other in the halls. Most serious problem, smoking cigarettes in the bathrooms in secret. And I remember, if anyone was caught doing any of these things, you'd get suspended from school. It was so outrageously criminal. Pretty bold. Now in the 1990s, she's repeating very nicely. What are the problems in the schools? The same survey explains. Rape. Murder. Drug addiction. Pregnancy of young girls. Raping teachers. Murdering teachers. Murdering of students. Drug addiction. Massive alcoholism. These are now the common problems in the schools of America. If you were to put some gum under your desk, you would probably win the award of the most pious student of the year. Now they don't smoke cigarettes in the bathroom. They murder each other and take cocaine and heroin. This is what's going on, and this is a fact. You've seen in the papers how many times this year students in high schools just come in with advanced artillery and just kill the students and the teachers. It happened in Georgia, it happened in Colorado, where else? I think it happened 4 times in 1 year. And none of these were inner city schools. These were all rich suburbs, where all the parents were very wealthy. These schools were very wealthy parent suburban schools. And yet the kids just come in and shoot for no reason at all. And no good reason. So we have to ask ourselves, are we advancing in civilization? We're giving all kinds of technical powers to people, but the fiber of their consciousness is degraded. What are we doing it for? So yes, Dr. Patil, I fully support your conviction that piety, morality, and spiritual truth based on love of Krishna, love of God, should be taught in every school. Otherwise, this is what happens. However, we may talk about it, but whether it happens or not is beyond our control. But at least within our own circle of our home, we can teach it. That we have the power to do. Sir, any other questions? Yes. It's possible to try. And many atheists, everyone has their free will. Many atheists will be convinced if we give them a logical reason to be convinced. Most people become atheists simply because no one has convinced them. There's two types of atheists, the innocent and the demoniac. The majority of all atheists or agnostics are innocent. They simply have not been convinced. They're inundated with all kinds of materialistic, atheistic propaganda, so they accept it. But their hearts are willing to hear. Those who are demonic, the more they hear, the more envious they become. Because they really, they don't want truth. They have wicked hearts, and they really and deeply and sincerely want to defy God for their own, for the promotion of their own purposes. So such people, it's very difficult to convince. But the masses are innocent. How? There are so many ways. If you study Srila Prabhupada's very books very nicely, this Bhagavad Gita as it is has made hundreds and thousands of atheists into very serious believers of God. Not only serious believers, but applying the teachings to their life day by day. You just ask them. The sun is shining. What are the chances of such an orbit, or such a massive globe as the sun, the earth, Mars, Saturn, Venus, all these planets, that they're all just floating in the sky, in their exact orbit, millennium after millennium after millennium? If this earth goes just a couple degrees closer to the sun's, all life will be burned to death. Yes? If it goes a few degrees further from the sun, everything will freeze and die. Yet since time immemorial, it has perfectly been within its orbit. Is this happening by accident? Does it make sense? Your own body? When you eat, do you know how digestions have taking place? Are you telling the stomach, you do this part, and then you direct, like an orchestra, conductor in an orchestra, you turn to the liver and say, now you do yours, and kidneys, now you do yours, and intestines, now do yours. You don't know what's happening. The average person, he eats, the energy is happening, the breaking of the enzymes and everything else is going on, the nutrition, the waste products, we don't know what's happening. Your hair is growing. Do you know how it's happening? Your eyes are seeing, your nose is smelling, your tongue is tasting. Do you know how it's happening? Can any man create this body that's working so expertly? Machines, if a machine breaks, it can't fix itself. But this human body, if it breaks, it fixes itself. You can invent the best computer, but can two computers come together and produce another computer? This incredible, most sophisticated machine ever created, the human body, which can think for itself, which can taste for itself, see for itself. Just the eyeball, how it works. The sense of taste, the fibers in the tongue, how they're working. How the ear is working, how the brain is working, how the heart is working. Each one is a massive science that even with all of our technology and all of our medical research, we haven't even hardly fathomed the depth of how these things are working. Is that true? And how they can just come together and produce another one. We have a famous gynecologist here. He knows these stories. My question to you, or to anyone, is we're not trying to be sectarian and beat you over the head, but just be reasonable. Is it more logical to believe that there is an intelligence behind this, or that it's all happened by chance? Which one? If there's an intelligence behind it, then that intelligence is the intelligence of God. Let's try to understand the possibilities of that, of the nature of that intelligence. That's the science of God. Is everything coming from nothing, or is everything coming from something? If everything is coming from something, that something is God. Let's try to understand. Here's the books that explain the science of God. So yes, anyone who is reasonable will accept at least the possibility that there may be a God. And if it's important enough to understand, then we study the science of the understanding of God. And people are convinced. People are scientifically minded these days. If Krishna consciousness is presented in a scientific way, most of the atheists will accept. But if we continue to try to present God consciousness in a very dogmatic way, we don't know, we don't understand, it doesn't matter, just believe. Because your grandfather believed, and your great-grandfather believed, and your great-great-grandfather believed. Therefore, you must believe. That worked in the past, but with modern education, people don't accept that very often. So we must present it logically, scientifically. Then people will be convinced, definitely. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much.